The way American families, the medical community, and society treat children with disabilities has changed over time. At one time, it was commonplace to simply send them away to institutions. There were a variety of reasons that families did that that included the hope of getting them specialized care, but also so family members without disabilities could live without what they saw as a stigma of being attached to someone with disabilities. Our next guest chronicles some of that history as she tells the story of discovering her own aunt who had been institutionalized by her family decades earlier. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that happened in your family? Do you have an experience with someone who was institutionalized with a disability at a very early age? Did you learn later in life about a family member, maybe one you didn't even know about? What questions do you have about how that practice came to be? What has happened since then? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer Senior is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She won the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for Feature Writing and the 2022 National Magazine Award for Feature Writing. She wrote about her family's story for the September issue of the magazine. The article is titled, "The Ones We Sent Away. I thought my mother was an only child. I was wrong." Jen, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to be here to talk about this. Thanks for having me.
When did you realize that your mom wasn't an only child, as you'd been raised to believe?
Yeah, I was 12. And it's a strange age to learn such a thing because, you know, you're on the cusp of kind of adulthood. So I had both kind of a child's disorientation where I thought, what? Huh? I've got another aunt. You know, my family is just effectively doubled in size because my father only had one sibling. And, you know, so it's sort of outrage. And also then an identification with my mother thinking, oh, my God, that means my mother hasn't seen her own sister. That means there was a lot of trauma involved for my grandparents. Mm-hmm. They sent a child away. So, yeah, I was 12 when I learned that.
And you eventually started digging in to learn more about your aunt Adele. Can you share briefly the story, why she was sent away?
So at the time, and this is language we would never use today, the words that they used were she was profoundly retarded. What she was developmentally disabled and intellectually disabled with no one at the time could identify what. We knew that the plates of her skull had closed prematurely. So she had microcephaly, and she wasn't meeting the traditional milestones that an infant might. What is interesting is that, not interesting, it's chilling. Once it was determined that my aunt was different, and for a full year, my grandmother suspected she was different, but the doctors all poo-pooed it. Once my grandmother was very bluntly told that my aunt was indeed different. And the way it happened is that a doctor very casually looked at my aunt and said, called her a microcephalic idiot, which again was a technical term back then. This was in textbooks, you know, in doctor's charts. My grandparents did this frantic circuit visiting all sorts of specialists in New York City, and they all, to a person, told my grandparents to send her away. And so she was sent away when she was 21 months, which is just, it sort of boggles the mind to think about that. I mean, you can't even really wrap your head around this. I mean, she was a baby, you know, she was a baby.
And this wasn't uncommon at the time you learned. This is what many people did. How widespread was this?
It was utterly widespread, much more common than not. It was extremely rare. Number one, you would have had to have withstood the intense pressure from the medical establishment. I mean, doctors were so authoritative back then, and or you know, invested with so much authority, and there they were in their white coats with their granite faces, you know, wagging their fingers at my poor working class grandmother who had never gone to college. I mean, and she went to one after another who all said that it wasn't just best for my mother, but in Adele's best interest, that was my aunt's name, that she would really benefit from a state institution, that that is where she would flourish. It's the only place where she would learn. And they didn't have much faith in her ability to learn, but to the extent that it was even possible, it could only be in that setting. This was sort of how it was done. I mean, there were no support structures back then. I mean, certainly schools weren't taking kids who were developmentally or intellectually different. There was no such thing. Nobody thought about neurodiversity with any kind of enlightened or open heart. I think that, you know, also there was no state funding for speech therapy and occupational therapy and physical therapy, all the things that you now get as a matter of course, generally for free. There was often a religious stigma attached to it. The thought was that, you know, maybe this was a punishment for your sins. Or there was the idea that, ooh, this was in your genes, right? It was scribbled into your bad DNA, you know, so it was a source of shame. There are all kinds of taboos around this, rather than being part of the glorious spectrum of humanity, right?
And you looked into what life was like, maybe if your Aunt Adele in some of these institutions and so many others, and it became a national scandal. Can you tell us a little bit about the conditions that many of these kids given up faced?
Yes. So it so happens that my aunt was in the very institution that became synonymous with this scandal. My aunt was placed in an institution called Willowbrook. And in 1972, well, I should back up. In 1965, Robert F. Kennedy, who was a senator in New York at that time, he came in, looked at Willowbrook, and declared it a snake pit. So we already knew, based on Kennedy, that it was a really, less than desirable place. But it wasn't until a young, unknown reporter named Geraldo Rivera, who came in unannounced with a camera crew. Excuse me, I've got something in my throat.
Sure.
I feel like I've swallowed a hairball just in time for your show. Let's try this one more time. So Geraldo comes in unannounced with his crew. They are, you know, and suddenly the footage is ghastly. It's like something out of a Renaissance depiction of hell. There are just wailing children and adults on the floor who are unclothed, rotting in their own diapers, in their own waste. They were not in school, quote unquote, at all. The fact that this place called itself a school was just laughable. It was risible. It was despicable. It was disgraceful. There was no stimulation at all. If an attendant so much as dropped a piece of paper on the floor, the people on the ward would fight for it because it could be crushed into a ball and played with. Each individual on the floor only had about 2.5 minutes to eat. And if you consider how many of them couldn't feed themselves, it's appalling. They were force fed. And some of them also had probably had GI issues that, you know, were undiagnosed. I mean, the conditions were so terrible. So that really was the beginning. It generated a kind of political will to close these places down and to create day programs. California provided a better model for this. They were already doing this. Kids were staying at home and going during the day to much more humane, you know, institutions. But all over the country, these kinds of state institutions were, you know, happening. It wasn't just Willowbrook. Willowbrook just became the notorious one, but they were everywhere.
We're talking to Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic about a piece she's written for the magazine's September issue, looking at the history and personal experience of institutionalizing children with developmental disabilities in the U.S. We'll go back to Jennifer in a little bit and hear the story of when she met her aunt Adele for the first time. Now, I want to bring in a Wisconsin perspective with Phyllis Greenberger, supervising advocacy specialist at Disability Rights Wisconsin, focusing on children's issues. Phyllis, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Nice to hear your story, Jennifer.
And these things, Phyllis, were happening here in Wisconsin, and that's part of the origin story of Disability Rights Wisconsin. Can you tell us a little bit about institutionalizing children with disabilities in Wisconsin's history?
That's true. Unfortunately, Jennifer's story is not uncommon, and Wisconsin also was, like Jennifer said, the whole country was doing this, and that there was a thought by doctors that it was better for the individual, for their parents, for their siblings, and encourage people to use institutions. And that was pretty common in the late 40s and early 50s. Here, just like it was, and into the 50s, just like it was in other places. And Wisconsin's change and national change did come from that reporting that Jennifer was talking about with Geraldo Rivera.
And can you talk about that transition, Phyllis, from these institutions in Wisconsin, starting, I think, in the 70s, when we started to move away from these kind of institutions?
Yeah, so in the probably late 60s and into the 70s, we started to work on more community-based programming. I think a lot of that came from parents beginning to feel like their children should stay at home, and parent advocates were a big part of some of this change. After this report in 1975, the protection advocacy system for individuals with developmental disabilities started in 1975, and that is our agency is part of that protection and advocacy system. And so there were also the Education for All Handicapped Children, which is now the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, was passed in 1975. Section 504 of the Rehab Act, which said you can't discriminate against people with disabilities, was in 1973. So there were a number of laws that started the change toward community-based programming. And then based on some of those laws, there was funding. As Jennifer had pointed out, now you can get community-based funding for all these kinds of services that people could not get at that time.
And Phyllis, before we let you go, if someone is listening, they have a disability themselves or have a child with a disability, they're looking for resources. They're looking for advocacy. Where are good starting points for them?
So if it's for your child, a good starting point is your school or your county. Those are two places that you can get some information. If you're struggling with some advocacy needs, you can also contact Disability Rights Wisconsin. And our website is Disability Rights Wisconsin or disabilityrightswi.org to get more information. But schools and counties are a good place to get information. And people do still struggle with this. As much as we've moved away from it, people do struggle to get the services they need. We've had a real crisis in providers for people with disabilities. And so definitely reach out if you need some help.
Phyllis, thanks a lot for joining us. That's Phyllis Greenberger.
Thank you for having me.
That's Phyllis Greenberger with Disability Rights Wisconsin. We're talking about a once common practice of institutionalizing children with developmental disabilities. Jennifer Senior stays with us from the Atlantic. We're going to pick up her family story in just a minute and maybe hear from you with your experiences at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic about her new piece called The Ones We Sent Away. She shares the story of her aunt who was sent to an institution as a child. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Stephanie is with us in Appleton. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about Stephanie?
So I live in Appleton, but I learned an adult now with my own children, but I learned probably my high school years upon talking with my mom and her two sisters, I learned of a brother that they had that I wasn't aware of. And turns out he was born in the early 1950s in Milwaukee, with known to have had Down syndrome, for sure. There are probably other medical things that weren't diagnosed at the time. But my grandparents were of stature in the community in the Milwaukee area. And so it was, for lack of a better word, an image thing and some other personal complications with not knowing how to provide best care, which I think Jennifer had mentioned earlier, too. People just didn't know what was best for individuals with disabilities at the time. So without the resources that they thought they could do the best for him, it was decided that he would be given up. They resigned their parental rights and he was institutionalized from the hospital. I actually was able to reconnect with him in my 20s, not too long ago. And I was in the process of working with his amazing guardian who voluntarily took care of him. Her name is Christy Bleakey, and she's just an amazing human. And our story has a happy ending in some regards. But it was similar in that we didn't know of him, or most of us didn't know of him, and it wasn't really spoken of.
Stephanie, thank you so much for sharing that story. A lot of common ground with your story, Jennifer. And from there, can you take us to when you first met your aunt Adele?
Yeah, God, I don't know whether it's depressing or affirming to hear how similar some of these stories are. But I met my aunt Adele the first time I was probably 28. It was in 1998. And I just sort of expressed an interest in meeting her. And my mother had gone such a long time without seeing her. She'd gone 40 whole years. I mean, you can imagine from her perspective, she was 6.5 years old. She's developed this relationship with her little sister, who, as far as she's concerned, is perfect. And at 21 months, this sister is mysteriously vanished, right? My mother is given this kind of half thought out explanation that my grandparents were trying as hard as they could. I'm sure they said that my aunt had gone to walking school. So for 40 years, my mother never saw her sister. It was a source of so much kind of torment and, you know, trauma, I think, for her. She had only seen her, she'd seen her right after her father died. So when she saw her with me when I was 28, it was her third time, and we really didn't bond. So it wasn't really until 2 years ago that I said, Mom, we've got to do this. She's still alive. And at this point, Adele was 70 years old. And that's when we really started visiting her in earnest.
Thanks a lot for that call, Stephanie. Mark is with us now in Bloomer. Mark, hello.
Hi there. Yeah, I'll say I totally disagree with this institutionalizing people. It's wrong. That being said, I understand the social pressure that would be on a family to do such an institutionalization. I remember the day when my mother, holding her most beautiful child, was told that she must have done something really horrible for God to have punished her with a child like that. And I remember my mother coming home from church sobbing, because she was told my brother should never come to church because he was disruptive. Thanks be to God that the pastor said, no, you bring your child to the church. Things change, and yet they don't.
Mark,
we have so much work to do.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. And Jen, that speaks to the pressure that you mentioned on parents. We might wonder why they'd be put in this situation. Mark's story shares some of that.
Well, yes, and also what I said about this being religious punishment, right? Mm-hmm. That was a really common refrain. You must have done something to incur God's wrath. I mean, imagine, right? You've just had this child, this beautiful child, and really, in the eyes of a church, I mean, we're all made in God's image. We should all be loved, right? And yet this was the line. I mean, it's as he said, it's really shameful. It's horrifying.
Thanks for sharing that story, Mark. Jennifer, as you said, it took a while, but you and your mom started regularly visiting your aunt Adele, and it ended up being a really, if I'm reading your piece right, a really good relationship. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Well, there are a couple of things that really stuck. Even when I visited her when I was 28, the similarities between her and my mom were really striking. My mother was going through this manic needle-pointing phase, and so was her sister. My mother was doing like the Chagall windows. She was doing these comically ambitious projects, and Adele was doing much simpler things, but I thought it was really interesting. My mother studied opera in college, and Adele could sing on key. So I knew about these similarities going in. So the weird thing is, the first time I see her, you know, when she's 70, now 21 years have gone by, both her and my mom are wearing these bright red sweaters. Like they're dressed identically, right? And they both are wearing these giant chunky beaded necklaces that they have both made, because they're both now simultaneously going through these like beading stages. And I just stared going, what? Seriously? And then I found out even more funny or sort of amusing to me is that my mother, you know, I love her, don't get in her way if you're trying to load the dishwasher. She's going to tell you that you're loading it wrong. She's got very firm points of view about how one loads a dishwasher. And it turns out that Adele, same thing. Like, heaven help you if you put a glass out of place, if anything is out of place, to the point that at their group home, one of the running jokes became people would slightly move things just like a quarter of an inch to the left just so that they could watch Adele silently go over and put it back to where it belonged. I mean, that's my mother. Like, the two of them, I don't know what it is. I don't know what that is.
Jennifer, I want to take a minute to maybe just give a shout out to one of the brightest spots in the story, the people who are caretakers at the group home for your Aunt Adele. Amazing. Tell us just a bit about them.
Oh, my God. So Carmen and Juan Ayala, I mean, their names ought to be written in the sky. They are saints. I mean, so caretakers are underpaid, underappreciated, undersung. They are everything. They are not doing this for the money. They are not doing this for the glory. They are doing this because many of them, because they feel that they have to. And Carmen and Juan, their house was just this, like, it just fills with joy. Juan in particular, like, was this kind of mirthful prankster who taught Adele how to salsa. They just, it was a house full of like in jokes and vaudeville pattern. Adele, who's the turkey head? Daddy's the turkey head. Just all of these wonderful, I mean, Carmen would wake up at 5 in the morning, 5 days a week with my aunt just to, like, you know, put on the perfume that she liked, to do her hair exactly the way she wanted it. And my aunt is so fastidious, right? Was so fastidious that had to be exactly right, right? You couldn't get that wrong. To bought her all the clothes she wanted to have bought. I mean, just all of these things, right? So, yeah.
That's, I like leaving it there, Jen. Thank you so much for sharing your family story with us.
Thank you so much for having me on to share it.
That's Jennifer Senior with The Atlantic. We talked to her about her new piece on how she discovered a lost aunt, one she didn't know about, who had a disability and had been institutionalized as an infant.